Stunned silence.
Oh, yes.
So
must be doing something, right?
And it's playing its playing this.
Tell us what you're doing.
I just can't
think
of it.
I love the enthusiasm.
You're tuned to the 15th Station, New Zealand's first Catholic podcast. This is episode 164 for July 2021. I'm your host, James, and in the virtual rendition studios tonight, we've got Gavin. How are you, Gavin?
Good, thanks, James. Lovely to talk to you.
Lovely to talk to you too, mate. I had a little pause there. I had to think about what year it was, what month it was, but I know whatever month and what year it is, whenever we were talking with Anna, it's a good month and year. Good to talk to you, Anna.
Thank you, James. Good to be back for another episode.
And it's great to have you back, and it's great to have back for another episode, the one, the only, the Don. How are you, Don?
What's up?
G'day, mate. G'day. How's everyone
going? We've seen
you
in person.
Yes, it was. We had a little 15th Station reunion tour of New Zealand. You guys came over a bit. It was great.
Yeah, they let us in. The bubble was open for a while, and then it was closed, and but we managed to stay in New Zealand for a couple of weeks, so it was nice to see you guys and family and friends for the first time in a number of months. So yeah, it was good. 18 months or so for Anna and about 16 months for me. So
it was fantastic. Yes. It was brilliant. Yeah, you did manage to get your timing actually really good there in the end.
It'll be lucky and good.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah.
And you got back okay because the bubble was sort of popping at the time that you were heading back, and so I was glad to hear that you're back in. Is it a bit chilly over there in Canberra?
So we had to hold our breath coming through Sydney because listeners all around the world might be hearing that Australia is having a bit of a resurgence in and around Sydney at the moment. So we were just told, hold your breath at the airport, get in a car and drive as fast as you can within the legal speed limit to get past the area that's affected, and then you can breathe out. So we did that.
You followed the instructions as required. Did you have masks and all that jazz on as well?
Indeed.
So good. And when we got back to Canberra, Canberra was a masked city, at least the public places, for the first time in the pandemic. So it was a bit of a change for us. It's no longer the case. So we just missed out where there were 2 weeks or maybe 3 weeks of masses with masks, at least 2 weeks. And our first Sunday back in Canberra, masks were no longer required at church. So so that made a little, and singing was back. So that was good.
Well, that is good. But it is a good reminder that, the world is very different nowadays, and especially this part of the world where, for the most part, we've enjoyed, relative normalcy, the new normal. But it is a reminder of how close things can be, and we do, of course, continue to keep in our thoughts and prayers all those around the world who are suffering from the pandemic, hoping that as this, as the various vaccines start to roll out, we start to get back to a better place. But it was great to see you guys in person, and glad to hear that you got home safe as well. It's good to see you in person as well, Don. Always good to see you too, mate.
Yeah, we let him.
Likewise, and considering we work very close to each other, we should probably see each other a little more.
We have offices that are very close to each other. We're not always in them with the working from home, but yes, we absolutely should, Don. That's a really good point. I'll draft a document on that. Whilst looking at this maybe draft document that's coming, this is from the US bishops from the Catholic News Service. That was a seamless segue. The president of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops has asked the nation's Catholics to pray for him and his brother bishops, quote, as we continue our dialogues and reflections in the process of drafting a document on the meaning of the Eucharist in the life of the church. Quote, I pray that this will be a time for all of us in the church to reflect on our own faith and readiness to receive our Lord in the Holy Eucharist, Los Angeles Archbishop Jose H. Gomez said in a statement released late June the 21st. During their virtual Spring General Assembly last month, the bishops approved in 168-55 vote, with 6 abstentions, the drafting of this document. The vote followed a lengthy debate on the 17th of June. The USCCB's Committee on Doctrine will draft it and present the document for discussion when the bishops reconvene in person in November for their Autumn General Assembly. My brother bishops and I voted overwhelmingly to issue a teaching document on the beauty and power of the Eucharist, Archbishop Gomez said. As the committee begins drafting it in the months ahead, the bishops will continue our prayer and discernment through a series of regional meetings and consultations, he said. noting they'll discuss the draft at their autumn meeting. Quote, "The Eucharist is the heart of the church and the heart of our lives as Catholics," he said. "In the Holy Eucharist, Jesus Christ himself draws near to each one of us personally and gathers us together as one family of God and one body of Christ. As bishops, our desire is to deepen our people's awareness of this great mystery of faith and to awaken their amazement at this divine gift in which we have communion with the living God," Archbishop Gomez added. "That is our pastoral purpose in writing this document." Well, well, Gavin, a announcement of a drafting of a document, not yet the document itself, but a bit of a vote there. There's a bit of politics going on. Do you want to unpack it a little bit for our listeners who don't follow the American side of things as much as you do, as you often do?
Yeah, so it's interesting. We got through, I don't know, about 8 or 10 paragraphs there without a mention of the US President Joe Biden. Because it's pretty hard to read any coverage of this particular topic without it that being front and center. There is a narrative, and you can agree with it or not, that this document is essentially a response to the presidency of Joe Biden, the second practicing Catholic in the history of the United States, and the first one really in this age of, abortion on demand in the U.S., and a number of other social issues on which the president has taken a position that many would argue is contrary to the church's teaching on those matters, abortion probably being the one most front and center. So when you listen to Archbishop Gomez's comments there, without that context, there was a study that came out, I think Pew Research or CARA, the big Catholic Research Institute, that spoke about the lack of understanding or lack of belief in the real presence in the Eucharist. So you could probably make an argument that a document like this makes sense with or without the Biden question. And I use Biden as code for Pelosi and a number of other people who tout their Catholic credentials but hold a number of policies. Again, abortion may be most prominent amongst them, that are contrary to the church's teaching. So there's a sense in which this document could have been necessary and important for the reasons Archbishop Gomez outlines in terms of the beauty of it for the faith and our communion with the living God, being reasons for a document like this to be put out to try and encourage Catholics to better understand what the Eucharist is. But as I say, the overwhelming narrative is that there's a group of bishops in the States, some might say 168 of them or thereabouts, who want to take on the president and his position. And, some have characterized it as a weaponizing of the Eucharist or language like that, which I think is unfair. I mean, we can have the debate we have before on the show, and we may again in this episode, around the worthiness or not of Biden to present himself to receive communion, and then the decision that a pastor or a bishop might make in terms of whether he would give communion to the president or some of these other politicians with these prominent views that are contrary to the church's teaching. So we can have that debate, certainly, but I think ultimately a document like this might be incredibly fruitful. In fact, I was doing some Googling and came across a document that the Irish bishops have put out on the Eucharist in recent years. So there is a sense in which there is an understanding that needs to be shared and nurtured and developed among the faithful, and a document of this nature would be a good way to do it. But rightly or wrongly, this seems to be completely tied up in sort of culture wars and how the bishops are trying to take on Joe Biden.
And Tyra's had a mental image of them trying to take him on in like a boxing ring, which would have been it's a political cartoon waiting to be drawn if it hasn't been already. But I mean, Anna, stepping back a little bit from the politics point of view, I mean, if I just look at this on the face of it, a document on the meaning of the Eucharist and the life of the church. There was a stat I saw recently talking about it was something crazy. More than half of Catholics, I think, surveyed in a Pew Research poll. I think it was. I shouldn't say Pew Research if it wasn't Pew Research.
It is Pew Research.
It was Pew Research, and they surveyed them and basically said more than half said that they thought that the Eucharist, the communion was just a symbol, didn't believe in the true presence. Oh, this is of Catholics. So surely
this is of Catholics. So of those who actually attend mass, so it's a third of those who actually attend mass. So two thirds don't believe it's true presence. So only a third think it's, and that's of mass attendees. Wow. And it dramatically increases when you have people who don't attend mass frequently, or weekly, and it goes up to 3/4 of people who don't attend frequently, who don't believe in real presence.
So, I mean, if you look at just at those stats, thanks, Don. Thanks, you good that you had them to hand. Like, Anna, from a teaching point of view, isn't it a good idea to write a document that's going to help teach people the meaning of the Eucharist and the life of the Church?
Yeah, I mean, if the Eucharist is the source and summit of our faith, which Vatican II very clearly said, that this is something that is necessary for all Catholics to believe. First of all, it's part of the content of faith. You could say it's the very sort of foundation of our faith, because it's about Christ. And it seems like there's obviously a need for catechesis on this this element of our faith. I think, I mean, apparently maybe in 2006, the US bishops put a document out on the Eucharist, but it sort of, they put it out and then it sort of just died, like, you know, wasn't held in
high esteem.
It just kind of died away, and there wasn't much catechesis from it. Whereas I hope that, so there's one thing to put out a document and establishing, I mean, in some ways, but they don't need to establish what the Church believes. We know what the Church has believed. She's believed it for 2,000 years. But perhaps to write it in a way that sort of speaks to the people of this era. But then also, what are they going to do with that document? And how are they going to promote and teach those articles of faith that are incredibly important for a Catholic to believe and to be able to live and to be nurtured in their faith from, right? So, I'm interested to see what they produce, but then also sort of the ongoing catechesis that needs to happen, also how it might be offered to politicians, Catholic politicians, as a way of, well, this is what you should be living, and are you actually living this? And if you aren't, then perhaps you know there might need to be some self-reflection and whatever else that needs to happen for you to come into this space. And it just shows just really like the real divided nature of politics in the States, and that seemingly you have to choose sides, whether you're a Democrat or Republican, and really Catholics can't really fit in either category, not fully. So it's pretty problematic, I think.
It is quite clearly a side that's more towards Christ's ideals than the other side.
So this, well, I mean,
I respectfully disagree. Ooh. That there is plenty in the Republican side that is abhorrent to Catholic teaching. Maybe you can say they don't hold because they don't have the sort of quite militant abortion policies, that there's something a little bit better about them, but you can't embrace Republican politics fully either.
Name one then.
You can't embrace about the Republican politics.
Yeah.
Death penalty would be one of them.
I disagree, and yeah.
You disagree with the Catechism then?
I don't agree. Well.
John Paul II, but
name that part in the Catechism that says that the death penalty is abhorrent and illegal, and
so there is possibility of the death penalty, but Pope Francis, Pope Benedict, and I think Paul the Sixth as well, maybe it was John Paul the Second, I can't remember. They have stated that in our modern times, that it is not a, it shouldn't really be used in modern times, that what we have makes it null and void at this time in history.
Yeah, it's basically the argument, and I know we've because we've covered this on previous episodes, right? The argument, not the argument, sorry, the teaching is that the death penalty was at a as a point of justice made sense when you had no other way of keeping people who, you know, were ignoring all other aspects of God's law and would just go around murdering people or whatever else, and you couldn't. Basically, in the world of a modern prison, where you have modern prisons, there's no justification for the death penalty because you can remove that person from the danger of community for the rest of their natural life. So the death penalty is therefore not justified in any situation where that can when they can hold. So the United States has no argument whatsoever for being able to be pro-death penalty. I think the, I mean, we've talked before on this, and I am keen for your take on it as well, Don, but we have talked before. Like, the reality of it is, if you're a Catholic voting in the States, you're picking between the, you're having to choose the lesser between two evils. Now, obviously, as we've talked about at length, so we probably don't need to get into it a huge amount, but at length,
I think we've talked about when you're looking at a million baby, well, close to 800,000 babies innocent a year versus people who've been tried in court and killed people who put on death row, and we're probably talking like on a federal level, maybe 10 a year. And on a
but that's before we get into things like just war doctrine. It's before we get into the fact that you've got, you know, the reality is that both like every political party around the world, unless there is a fully Catholic political party, there is no such thing. So there will always be political parties.
Absolutely. Right. I just don't think that there's equivalency between what the Democrats believe and what the GOP believe. And absolutely, there are things that are there are issues with GOP policy, but to put them in the same stratosphere of morality, I think is absolutely wrong.
Are there some things in Republican policy that a Catholic Republican would make a Catholic Republican not worthy to receive communion?
Ooh. So in terms of formal cooperation,
I think there is. So I agree that abortion is like the most monstrous thing. But if we can't just aim this Eucharistic coherence at Democratic politicians, we must, but all politicians, because I think that there is stuff that the Republican Party stands for, and certainly maybe congressmen or senators, or, you know, who have pursued particular policies that perhaps place them in a position where perhaps they shouldn't be receiving communion, which is
maybe a grey area. I wouldn't say it's definitely clear in terms of the death penalty one, but can you name something else that a GOP politician doesn't have the risk? Discretion in terms of morality.
Well, definitely the death penalty one, because that's something that's been clearly spoken about.
I'd still say it's in the grey area.
Drifting off.
I think that's one thing, and that's enough, right?
I think what this would speak to, though, is that the need for clarification of teaching when it comes to being in a state of grace and being able to receive the Eucharist and what that means, I think that is something which is of merit. I think the fact that we've talked before that Joe Biden being the first for a long time practicing Catholic president who, the part that isn't, that is, you know, this part that we're just talking about in terms of the position that the government has on abortion, or that the Democratic Party has on abortion, that is an area where you go, okay, well, that one's pretty... well, not black and white, even though I think to us it would probably seem it is, hence why they go, okay, well, let's make this thing apply. But I think, Anna, your point is 100% valid in the sense that this would need to apply for all those. Like, if it's truly a meaning of the Eucharist in the life of the church, Don, then it should be talking for all Catholics, right? It doesn't matter whether they're the president, senator, or just, you know, Joe Public going to Mass. If the focus of this is trying to draw to attention to the fact that that the commander-in-chief holds positions which are incongruous, fine, but it can't just be, this is not a letter to Joe Biden, right? This is a teaching document to Catholics in the United States and beyond, right?
Well, to the United States ultimately, but because it's from the US bishops, but
good point.
We will read it. and probably comment on it.
I imagine so. Yeah.
The poll came out well before Biden, and those results well before the election.
Which says that this is needed, right? Like, I think anything that can be done to try and explain to people, that alone, forgetting for a moment, the president and politics, just looking at the fact that more than half of Catholics who attend, what's the stat, Don, of how many that attend Mass?
Of those who attend Mass, it's only a third that actually believe in true presence, and only 25% of those who don't regularly attend Mass.
Right, so two-thirds of those who attend Mass believe it's just a symbol. At the source and summit, as you pointed out, Anna, from Vatican II, source and summit of our faith, that they don't believe it's true presence. And I think that line there from the Archbishop and the Holy Eucharist, Jesus Christ himself, draws near to each one of us personally, gathers us together as one family of God and one body of Christ. I mean, anything that can be done to help people better connect with that reality, I think is a good thing. Oh, spicy one to start with. Let's go from there to burning down churches, shall we? This one from SBS. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has announced the burning and vandalism of Catholic churches that has followed the discovery of unmarked graves at former schools for Indigenous children. Several Catholic churches have recently been vandalized or damaged in fires, following the discovery of more than 1,100 unmarked graves at the sites of three former residential schools run by the church in British Columbia and Saskatchewan that generations of Indigenous children had been forced to attend. There were also a series of attacks on July the 1st, Canada Day, on statues of Queen Victoria, Queen Elizabeth, and other historical figures. Mr. Trudeau, himself a Catholic... Is he a Catholic? Sorry, I should edit that out. I genuinely didn't know that he was Catholic. Okay, Mr. Trudeau, himself a Catholic, said he understands the anger many people feel toward the federal government and the Catholic Church. The government has apologized for the schools, and Mr. Trudeau has called on Pope Francis, too, to make a formal apology. Quote, it's real, and it is fully understandable given the shameful history we have all become more aware of, he told a news conference. I can't help but think that burning down churches is actually depriving people who are in need of grieving and healing and mourning from places where they can grieve and reflect and look for support. That's true. Anna, what do you make of this? So, the terrible news, obviously, of the burning of Catholic churches seems kind of a bit of a... I won't editorialize any further than that. I'm keen for your take on it.
I sort of reflecting on this article earlier today, and I thought, gosh, what's happened in our world where we see something that's unjust and maybe horrifically so, and we then respond by doing criminal activity and horrendous criminal activity. Like, thinking of, some of the riots and stuff after, unlawful killings of people and things like that. And you just see it everywhere now, right? Like, it's just happening all over the place, and it's quite disturbing. We don't know how to get justice anymore. We just kind of have to be, revengeful or, vigilantes or something like that. I don't know. So I have been really disturbed by that response to, obviously that whole era of, and it's happened in many countries where Indigenous peoples have been poorly treated, and not like their dignity hasn't been upheld and they haven't been cared for, especially the children. And here in Australia, there's been a pretty horrendous record of that as well. And it's hard to make it right, and I don't think you ever can, but I don't think we really know how to move on from these things or how to get justice when it's historical, and how to perhaps sort of reconcile the various parties. And I'm not sure what the answer is, but and apologies are important, and I'm glad Trudeau has apologized for the government's part. Whether he's got a leg to stand on to call then for the Catholic Church to apologize, because in some respects, if you make someone apologize and then they apologize, it's somewhat, like insincere, or maybe, I don't know. It just kind of muddies the waters a wee bit, I suppose. I'm not sure I'm sure that there's stuff going on in Canada now to try to bring healing to this situation. But it's a pretty difficult situation all around. And the response by burning down churches or rioting or destroying other people's property is just not the answer. I think it just makes the situation even worse.
Well, Anna, to be fair, are you not familiar with that age-old theological and philosophical teaching that two wrongs always make a right?
Indeed, right?
I mean, there's an element of this, Don, which I find, troubling is doesn't do it justice, right? This is a situation which is obviously complex. We still don't have all the details. What we've got is a lot of media reporting of some numbers which sound terrible, taken out of historical context, which of course we love to do. And then we've got this response that seems to be about vengeance and revenge and anger, because I don't see how burning down a church, especially one that's not related to a government policy, I don't see how that makes anything better. I don't know if you do or if you've got some insights into this.
Oh, it absolutely doesn't. And if you look at the logic, okay, burning down churches of people who may have done, because we don't know what's happened. It was like many, many, many decades ago, of people who are long dead, who happen to be the same race and happen to be the same religion as people who are alive today, even though those policies no longer exist. And punishing those people who happen to be of the same race and religion of people who did bad and forcing them to apologize.
It makes total sense. That's a good point. Yeah, yeah.
So, I just don't know what the logic is. It's absolutely, it's neo-Marxist kind of anarchy, really. It's the old kind of power structure, Catholic Church bad, white people bad, indigenous people good. It's that classic kind of neo-Marxist identity politics, and it's disgusting.
Just for anyone at home who's playing the Don drinking game, that's two mentions of neo-Marxist, right? So I don't know, what the penalty is for that. No, but to your point. I think there's something about this kind of, particularly when you go through that logic chain, right? It is very, very far removed. And it more comes, I don't know, Gavin, it sort of seems to speak to people being just angry and, wanting to vent their anger and then doing so in a very destructive and evil way, which evil just begets more evil, I guess.
Yeah, we spoke about this last month when it was sort of breaking news almost. And I think probably one of the things we've found in the month or so since our last podcast is that the initial reporting was probably a little sensationalist. Some of the language used was a little bit imprecise. I think there was talk about mass graves rather than unmarked graves, and maybe I'm splitting hairs here, but they are quite different things to my mind. And there's certainly been a lot of comparison with what had happened in Ireland, where some of the reporting failed to fully and accurately describe what had happened in some of the orphanages and other facilities that the church sisters and brothers normally had run in Ireland as well. So there certainly is a sense, and I will be accused of defending the church and unjustifiably and what have you, but there is certainly a narrative that anything the church does has to be bad, and therefore if the church is related to a government policy, I think the numbers I saw was something like 60% of the residential schools in Canada in these decades were run by the Catholic Church or operated by the Catholic Church, carrying out government policy. If the church is involved, so that says that 40% of the schools were run by someone else. Now, that may have been the government or it may have been some other organizations, but I haven't read anything about them. Nor about any other buildings being vandalized other than some of these historical figures and their statues that have been toppled and vandalized and other things. So we do see this, I was going to say from time to time, but it's pretty regular at the moment, where anything to do with the church is seen as more sinister than anything any other organization could carry out. Yeah, there's reasons for that. and our recent past hasn't helped. We don't get the benefit of the doubt because of the last few decades, and these things that we're talking about in Canada probably go back, you know, 150 years, I think, or certainly well over 100 years. So the church certainly has some things to answer for the ways that people behaved, but the disproportionality, I think, is something that needs to be considered and questioned in terms of how the church is being maligned seemingly more than anybody else, including the government, I would say, and again, the damage and destruction that the Prime Minister did manage to get something right, and that the destruction and vandalism of churches is not helping anybody, and certainly not going to help with the grieving or reconciliation process for those whose ancestors were treated poorly and are seeking some sort of justice, and that won't come through the burning of churches.
No, it won't. And I mean, the thing that I sort of struggle the most with this, I mean, I think you summarized it brilliantly there, is this is a government policy at the time, right? This is one of those issues where you go, the church is kind of damned if it does and damned if it doesn't. The very, very justified anger that comes from the reality of the abuse scandal, and that is definitely the church not following government, you know, law and policy in terms of moving people around and things like that. So rightly so, we all get very angry and go, "This is ridiculous, you know, terrible and abhorrent and evil and all the rest of it," which it is. Then you take a situation where you've got the church following exactly what the government, what my understanding from the reading, right? This was a government policy that they were sort of following through in terms of running these schools, and colonialist approach was, you know, that's what you did when you were a school under a government and you were following the law. So I kind of look at it and go, well, and then we get all angry about it, because what we hear is the number. That's the thing. We hear the number 1,100 unmarked graves, and everyone immediately connects things that aren't necessarily connected. If they were connected, if there was 1,100 unmarked graves of children who were murdered by, or who would, you know, some terrible thing that had become, you sit there and go, okay, then we should do what we do. Whenever we find these kind of situations, these historical atrocities, we should investigate. We should dig into them. We should find out what's going on here and see what can be done, what can be done to repair, if anything can be done to repair. You don't just go around and firebomb a church. Like, that just seems ridiculous to me. And I kind of get the sense that, you know, there's what's the term in civil law about, you have to come to law, you have to come to the thing with in clean hands. In other words, don't take it into your own, don't take it under your own and go take, you know, go vigilante justice on the whole thing, because it's just not going to improve things. Well, I guess we just sort of can only hope that sanity will prevail, that facts will come out so we can find out exactly what we're dealing with, and that defacing statues and, you know, firebombing churches doesn't help anyone at all. Let's go to something a bit more hopeful, shall we? This one from ANZ Catholic. The newly appointed Dean of Te Kupinga, the Catholic Theological College, Dr. John Evangelista, has big dreams for the college and for Catholic education in New Zealand. Hopefully this will be the seed for the future Catholic University of New Zealand, he said. We have a rich history of Catholic education here in New Zealand, very good primary and secondary schools. Why not a university? Dr. Evangelista, a medical doctor who earned a licentiate in theology at the University of Navarre at the Roman College of the Holy Cross in Rome, is inspired by the words of Pope Benedict XVI, who said that Catholic education, quote, nurtures the soul of a nation. Quote, if you could imbibe Christian values into sciences, mathematics, the arts, history, and everything else, it would make a big difference, he said. Dr. Evangelista said he may not see a university happening in his lifetime, but he can sow the seeds for now. Since he started working at CTC, they have put together a 3-year strategic plan that has been which has been endorsed by their governance board. This is putting in the foundation for what we would like to see happen in the future, he said. The first point in this plan is to increase awareness of CTC. Only a very limited number of people really know what we're doing, since the merger only started in January 2020. We still need to tell people what we are doing and what CTC is all about, he said. Dr. Evangelista said another priority is succession planning to future-proof the college. A lot of our senior lecturers are close to retirement or are at retirement age. The median age really would be about 64 to 65 years old. We have to prepare so that in the next 5 years, they would have already trained their successors, he said. Well, Don, what do you make of this? Would you go study at the Catholic University of New Zealand? This is what the newly appointed dean wants to sow the seeds for. What do you make of all of this, mate?
Oh, I think it's good as long as it's Catholic. Like, I think I've made my views pretty clear in the past about Catholic education in New Zealand at the secondary school level and the primary kind of school level. And Catholic education is great at all levels as long as it's Catholic.
Yes. Yes, I agree.
And there's lots of things that are, you know, Catholic in name, but they're not really Catholic. And I think our secondary schools and the number of vocations that we get from that is a indictment on the process and of our Catholic schools today. And we just lack catechism, catechesis. And we'll probably have similar stats in terms of people who come out of Catholic schools and believe in true presence and you know, Catholic stuff like that. So, yeah, anything that teaches actual Catholicism, be it tertiary, secondary, primary level, is fantastic.
Yeah, okay. All right. Gavin, what about you, mate? What do you make of this idea and this big plan for eventually one day having a Catholic University of New Zealand? Is that just a branding thing, or do you see that as something for the Catholic Theological College to try and grow into?
Well, I think there's value in, I mean, I'm not an expert on what, you know, you need to do in order to become a university versus just a theological college. In Australia, there are two predominant Catholic universities, the University of Notre Dame Australia and the Australian Catholic University. There's also Campion College, which is a liberal arts college. And then there are a number of theology institutions, including those that teach seminarians and the like, and lay people in most of the capital cities around the country. So I think in New Zealand it would be, I mean, I think there's merit in trying to grow the number of people who study theology, and Dr. Evangelista has certainly spoken about the need to have people who can teach theology for the next generation of teachers. The thing that has largely sustained the particularly ACU, Australian Catholic University, but I think probably Notre Dame as well, ACU's got a longer history, is the number of people training for Catholic schools, which is a much larger network in Australia, well, I think not just proportionally, but beyond that as well, and Catholic hospitals and aged care facilities and the training of nurses. So I don't know whether the church has any governance of any hospitals in New Zealand anymore. Obviously, the Mercy Hospital, Martyr Hospital, was Catholic with the Mercy Sisters. I don't think that's still the case. They may have involvement, but certainly not with any sisters involved, I wouldn't think. So I think without, you know, unless it became the place at which people would do their education degrees in order to teach in Catholic schools, which would be a large number of people coming through that system in New Zealand as well. I think that could, you know, grow the student base. But I think there's probably just a need for the Catholic Theological College, which is only just sort of finding its feet, to actually figure out what it is doing and to grow from, I don't know, 2 or 3 dozen students, I suspect, to, you know, 100 students, 300 students over the next few years. To try and help train people in genuinely Catholic teaching so that there can be these people who can become the new teachers in those colleges and other people who can go into leadership positions in Catholic schools and in dioceses and those sorts of things. So I'm not too hung up on the terminology of what an institution might be called. I'd rather see it find ways to grow and to authentically train people to work within the church, but beyond the church as well, but people who would be grounded in Catholic understanding of the world and the human person.
Yeah, well, that would be great, as you say. Anna, you've got some experience with Catholic education in New Zealand. What's your sort of take on the vision here for the CTC?
I feel like this is a vision that's been around for a while. Certainly when I was part of that scene in New Zealand. I guess I'm a bit of a fruit of that vision as well, in the sense of trying to find the, you know, people in the younger generations to be able to teach theology and things like that. I think that maybe, I don't know, Dr. Evangelista at all, but and I've sort of been out of that situation, so I don't know sort of the developments that have happened, but I certainly had some thoughts about the development of you know, the education of people in order to have lecturers to future-proof the succession of lecturers in the country. And I'm not sure if any of my ideas have been taken on board, but yeah, I think you're just not going to get anywhere unless you've got that base of people. Even if you could somehow have a university that taught things other than theology, that had other faculties, you know, having people who know their faith well and live their faith, as well as have qualifications in other areas. It's pretty hard to find, I think, in New Zealand. I just don't think we have big enough Catholic population.
Is that what makes it a university, having other colleges, essential faculties?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm. And so, and that point around, well, how would you see? So let's say you're the newly appointed dean. Ooh, there you go. Ooh. Magic wand. What would be the way you would describe the what kind of seeds would you be sowing? Let's say that. What kind of seeds would you be focused on sowing to either achieve this vision of being a Catholic University of New Zealand or to achieve more than that?
Well, I think you know, my involvement sort of came about because the numbers of priests and religious who were available to do that kind of stuff were dwindling, and they really wanted lay people to, you know, take on that kind of work in the Church in New Zealand, which is great. And I was very grateful to, you know, be able to do that for a short time. But having lay people in doing that kind of work is quite different from having priests and religious. So lay people have to provide their own home and food, and they have families, and like they need to be paid more, just full stop. Plus there's other considerations of family life and things like that that are just a bit more difficult to navigate than, you know, a priest who, you know, you basically just get paid a stipend or something like that, you know, and if you don't want them to work for you anymore, then they have somewhere to live and, you know, and all that kind of stuff. So I think it was a little bit around that, and even just the process of studying, doing the studies that are needed in order to fulfill those positions. As a lay person, it looks quite different. It's just a different, it should be a different process. Actually, one of the things I was reflecting on was about sort of mentorship and how I really wish that I had had a mentor as I was sort of going through this journey. You know, someone who'd been through it before me and could help me to navigate what was to come for me, especially on the academic side, because that's, you know, it's a pretty full-on area to navigate. And I just, yeah, I think you kind of have to set up the structures so that you can bring people through. Not just, can we find people who are willing? That's one aspect. But another aspect is, if we find these willing people, are we able to help them to go through this whole process and sort of keep them part of the, you know, help them to go all the way through? So I think there just needs to be a lot more sort of stability or structure around that whole process.
Really good thoughts. And I mean, like you say, I mean, it's something that you've definitely, been involved in and got a lot closer to it than I am. I kind of feel like, I remember when I was studying at the university, the non-Catholic university here, and thinking to myself, I wonder what, maybe I would take a couple of theology papers, or, you know, and I never really got around to it. And I wonder why that was. And I wonder if some of it was just awareness and some of it was that there was nothing really pushing and promoting me to get into it, or if it was that I didn't, maybe I was just lazy. And maybe if there's other situations where, you know, to get part, you know, Gavin's point of maybe a few dozen, get that to a few hundred students who are learning more, and then see what that means for maybe some of those who want to continue into a career teaching in that space. But then, as you say, Anna, there's quite a number of things to change when you're lay people who are, yeah, it's complicated, isn't it? Complicated.
Yeah.
Well, I do wish and pray for all the success for the CTC. And Dr. Evangelista, wishing you all the very best for your deanship, deanhood. I'm not sure your office of your deanery, whatever it is. I just really anything that can help with educating people more in the faith is a good thing. Speaking of good things, this is from Vatican News. Pope Francis sent a tweet on July the 7th, thanking people around the world for their kind messages and care regarding his health, as he continues his recovery at Rome's Gemelli Hospital following his surgery. The Pope writes in his tweet, "I am touched by the many caring messages received in these days. I thank everyone for their closeness and prayer." Among the many messages Pope Francis has received, the testimony of His Holiness Karakin II, Supreme Patriarch and Catholicus of all Armenians. Is that Catholicus of all Armenians?
Catholicus, maybe?
Okay, stands out. In a message yesterday, he addressed his beloved brother in Christ, assuring the Pope that we pray to the Heavenly Lord to guard and protect you in his mercy, granting you longevity and many fruitful years in your pontificate. Several heads of state and government also wished to express their closeness, including the President of Taiwan, Tsai Ing-wen, who sent a message on July the 5th. That same day, the President of the State of Palestine and of the PLO Executive Committee, Mahmoud Abbas, wrote from Ramallah, "Let us all pray together to God to give you health in order to continue in your commitment to the creation of peace and love among peoples." Cardinal John Achley Dew, Archbishop of Wellington and President of the New Zealand Bishops' Conference, stated that every New Zealand Catholic will mention Pope Francis in their prayers. That's a big commitment, Cardinal Dew. Rejoice, but I'm sure we're rejoicing in knowing that the Holy Father has managed well with the surgery and is recovering. Gavin, this is good that the surgery went well and that the Pope is recovering. And isn't it nice to hear sort of people from all sorts of different walks of life sending in messages of well-wishing?
Yeah, I'm not sure we're going to get too much. I don't mean to speak for Don, but I'm not sure we're going to get too much dissension on this. We sort of breaking news as we're recording the podcast that the Pope will spend a few more days in rehabilitation. After the surgery, he probably would have been out sort of around the 14th of July, I think, based on the original predictions, but he'll spend a few more days in hospital. I mean, there were stories, I think, late last week, oh, you know, the Pope's running a fever. It's like, dude, he's 84 or something. 84-year-olds don't recover like 44-year-olds or 54-year-olds or other people with a four in their number. The President of the Bishops' Conference in Australia tweeted something, and he was sort of saying that there's something in Scripture, I think in Acts or one of those early books around, you know, the whole church prayed for Peter, and the Archbishop Coleridge said, you know, and so we do today, and so much as, you know, people around the world are praying for Pope Francis. I remember waking up because the surgery was not sort of pre-announced. Well, I guess the surgery was. Him going to hospital was not pre-announced, so I sort of woke up one morning and there was all these social media stuff. Oh, the Pope's in hospital and, oh, you know, let's pray for the Pope. And I thought, initially didn't know, you know, why he was in hospital. So it was obviously a pre-planned procedure. A man in his 80s, any procedure is, has its risks, but obviously pleased that he made it through and that he was able to pray the Angelus from the hospital balcony the other day. So we do. I'm not sure whether all Catholics in New Zealand prayed on that day for the Holy Father, but I think we can probably say that we continue to hold him in our prayers, that he will his recovery will continue to go smoothly.
I mean, it could be the fact that we try to pray for the Pope in every Mass, right? So maybe that was it, every New Zealand Catholic. mentions them in the prayers.
We do pray for the Pope at every Mass.
Yeah. We do, don't we? We do. Sorry, when I say try to. Yes, they're good. Yeah, but, thank you.
But I'm not sure about that particular weekend, but there may or may not have been Masses in the Archdiocese of Wellington at that point, because they were shut down for a while because of the little COVID.
Yes.
The priest
would have prayed their own Mass.
They would have. Anna, what about you? What do you make of the, it's good sort of seeing, different people replying with, sending those kind of messages in, isn't it?
Yeah, and there seems to be, obviously there's a sort of, there's a protocol of diplomacy that, if one is a leader of this state, they might, contact another leader of another state if something happens, whatever, there's that sort of, courtesy perhaps. But I did sort of reflect that some of these messages did seem quite affectionate, or there was a genuine warmth, thank you, given, and concern for him. And he is elderly, he's an elderly man, and it was a pre-planned, was sort of not a routine, but maybe routine-ish kind of operation. But yeah, there's always a significant risk for someone of that age. And I'm hoping that his recovery continues, and that he's able, he's been doing a lot. There's been a lot going on in the Vatican lately, and I'm hoping that the things that he has started to do will be able to continue while he recovers, and then when he's back to full health, that he might,
I feel like he's timing it really well, because, Rome basically shuts down in August, right?
Well,
so if his recovery takes a bit longer, then he'll sort of be able to go straight from recovery into the holiday.
Well, I'm not sure if that's why it was timed, but it's good. I like the way you think there, Gavin. And Don, what about you? Anything to add on the messages praying for the Pope's recovery?
Yeah, I'm not sure what kind of monster Gavin thinks I am. I do wish the Pope good health and longevity, although I may have differences with him in terms of church politics and his stewardship of the Holy Catholic Church. I wouldn't shed a tear if he were to resign, but I do wish him the very best in terms of good health and longevity.
Right.
Well, the rumours have already started on the resignation front.
Oh, have they?
Yeah.
They have to start running a retirement home for popes at this point. Basically, Don, 2 out of 3, you're aligned with the Supreme Patriarch of all Armenians. 2 out of 3, you also pray the Heavenly Lord for guard and protect in his mercy, granting him longevity and many fruitful years, just not necessarily of his pontificate. Is that where we sort of draw the line?
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Well,
Got it in one.
2 out of 3. We do here. I think I can speak on behalf of the 15 station crew, Your Holiness, where we say that we do pray for your speedy recovery, as we do for all those that are facing illness and surgery at this time. Pray that you can get back to robust health to continue whatever work the Lord is calling you to do. And speaking of the Pope, this one from America Magazine, maybe what's being asked of the Pope is to meet more of his heroes. This is from the American Magazine at his weekly audience on the Vatican on June the 23rd. Pope Francis had a special visitor, Spider-Man. Well, not quite. just in case anyone was actually thinking that Spider-Man was... Mattia Villadita, a 28-year-old man, from Northern Italy, was dressed as the superhero, his childhood idol. It helps that he channels many of Spider-Man's most noteworthy qualities by bringing joy to children in need. Oh, that's good. Mr. Valadita was invited to sit in the VIP section of the San Damaso courtyard, where the general audience of the Pope Francis has been taking place during the pandemic. And he was easy to spot as he sat at the end of one of the rows dressed in full Spider-Man costume, next to a priest wearing all black. I love that. He was quite easy to spot, you know. Now, if he'd been sitting around with a bunch of cardinals, all wearing red, might have been a little bit harder to spot him.
Or other spiders.
Other spider-man. The real-life superhero was invited to the audience because of his everyday commitment to bring joy to suffering children. Sorry. Look, I'm not laughing. It's fantastic. What a lovely guy in terms of the work that he does in terms of bringing joy to suffering. I am having a little chuckle more at the American magazine's reporting of it. But anyway, there we go. Isn't that nice? The Pope got to hang out with Spider-Man before he went in for a surgery?
Yeah, well, we didn't know he was going in for surgery. No. So maybe this was a harbinger of things to come. Mm. Maybe Spider-Man went and saw him in hospital.
Well, maybe. Well, so, I don't know. Yeah. Mm. I don't know how many other people, how many other Marvel or DC superheroes have sat in the VIP section of the San Damaso courtyard. Not many, if any. We would have covered them. I'm pretty sure that we would have covered them over the...
They would have made the criteria on the light story.
They would have made... Gavin's got a very strict criteria for the light story on the 15th station. Long-time listeners will know.
It has been criticised a bit recently, I must say. The selection of light stories is not that light. But anyway, I think I got it today.
Yes, you did. This is definitely a light story. This is not for me. Yeah, not like a dark comedy like some of the other, black comedy like some of the other ones have been a little bit sort of on the more morose side. But this one's good. This is positive. Mainly because I'm a Marvel fan. Anna, what do you make of Spider-Man hanging out? I mean, is there something about appropriate dress? Can we turn this into a controversy about Don? Are you going to talk to me about what's appropriate to wear when you're at the Vatican?
Well, we've got our very own superhero, and he walked on water and, you know, raised the widow's son and fed 5,000 people, healed a paralyzed man, stilled a storm, and rose from the dead.
Who was
pretty,
that, Don?
Pretty amazing.
Who was that?
I'm quite sure.
Can't remember his name. Yeah. I think Spider-Man's okay because I think he had his his pants went past his knees, which I think isn't that the requirement.
Oh yes, yes, very Vatican. Much so.
Yep. His shoulders were covered. His shoulders were covered. That's an important thing as well, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and he wasn't
particularly
really
for the ladies. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Well, good on you, Mattia. Mattia?
Spider-Man.
Mr. Valadita.
Mr. Man, first
name Spider. Good on you, buddy. Like, good on you. And like, it's a lovely story in terms of what he does, helping suffering children. So that's fantastic. And if you don't believe me, if you think that there have been other superheroes that have visited the Vatican and we have been remiss in our coverage, you are more than welcome to go back and listen to the previous 163 some episodes. You can go find them at www.station15.co.nz. There you can subscribe for free. Or you can find us at, you can find us on Spotify, you can find us in iTunes, you can find us in Google Podcasts, just wherever you find your podcast, just search for The 15th Station. If you find that in your podcatcher of choice, we're not appearing for whatever reason, send us an email to feedback@station15.co.nz, or if you just want to say hi, you can send one too. Thanks very much. A couple of listeners reaching out recently, and we've covered off some of the stories, in fact, that a few of you have mentioned. So it's always great to hear from you. You can also reach out to us at facebook.com/station15 or twitter.com/station15. Just leaves me to thank everyone. Thanks very much, Don. Great to talk to you, buddy.
Likewise, and catch up for lunch soon.
Oh, mate, absolutely. Let's just make sure we're in the offices at the same time, and that'll be great. We can make that happen. And it'll probably be a little bit before we catch up for lunch, Anna, but I'll look forward to when we do. It's great to talk to you.
Yeah, you too, James, and good to see you a few weeks ago. Good.
It was fantastic. It really was. It was genuinely lovely to see you, and it was always good. I don't know if I say lovely to see you, Gavin, but it was always great to see you in person, mate. And
the
great
feeling
to talk
is
to you
mutual.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. No, it was brilliant.
Thanks for navigating it through another episode.
It was good. It's good. It's a spicy one a little bit, but it's good. You know, this is why we're here. This is why we love listening, love having you all here listening to us. And we hope that everyone out there is, enjoyed the show. And until next time, take care and God bless.
This production is affiliated with SQPN, the StarQuest Production Network, leading the way.